This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President expresses concern about growing ties between Iran and China days after Tehran and Beijing sign a strategic cooperation pact. The UN chief criticizes developed countries for what it calls very unfair distribution of coronavirus vaccines in the world. Australian Prime Minister announces a cabinet reshuffle as part of attempts to placate public anger over sexual abuse scandal in Parliament. I'm Ben Husner, Jeffrey. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Starting off with our top story, the U.S. President has expressed concerns about the newly signed Iran-China Comprehensive Partnership Agreement.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the comment in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. Tehran and Beijing signed a cooperation pact adopted as the Sino-Iranian Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed during a visit by Chinese foreign minister to Iran. It includes cooperation in political, strategic, and economic fields. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as banking and telecommunication sectors. A political commentator Brian Berletic says that the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
I think it shouldn't come as much of a surprise that nations like Iran or China or Russia, for that matter, would begin working together. These are all nations that seek good ties with nations all around the globe, and now with this pressure on them from the United States, it only makes sense for them to all work together specifically regarding this pressure. So I think For the U.S. president to say that he's worried about countries cooperating around the globe, that's a strange thing to say. It's a strange thing to hear a president of a country that poses as a global leader condemning cooperation. And it's constructive cooperation at that. So it's a promising sign from China and Iran, and it's troubling to see America's reaction to it.
Social media giant Facebook is at it again. It's closed the account of Press TV news channel for as many times as one can remember. Even though Facebook preaches free speech as one of its pillars, it has failed to apply that to Press TV. The Iranian news channel says it won't let Facebook suppress its mission to tell the truth about world events.
Facebook has once again shut down the page of Press TV News Network, this time permanently, in yet another attack by the U.S.-based social media giant on Iranian media outlets. Facebook said in a note that this decision is irreversible. The company attempted to shut down Press TV's account without giving any prior warning. Facebook justified the act by claiming that Press TV has failed to follow the Facebook community standards. However, the company did not specify the so-called violations of its rules. The social media platform has, on a number of occasions, attacked Press TV, despite its own claim of providing space for freedom of expression. One such attack took place in mid-January, when Facebook temporarily deleted Press TV's page, which had more than 4 million followers. The news outlet, however, had its page restored after appealing the platform's decision to remove it. The attack coincided with Press TV's coverage of post-election violence in the U.S. Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship, not just on Facebook, but also on other fronts, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Over the past years, Facebook, along with other mentioned companies, have repeatedly targeted Press TV, among other media outlets of Iran, and the countries critical of the West and the Israeli regime's occupation of Palestine. It appears that the UK has also followed the footsteps of the US when it comes to censoring media. The UK broadcast regulator Ofcom recently stripped the Chinese media company of operating on its cable network, an exact move that it did to Iran's Press TV back in 2012.
I think we need to recognize that in today's day and age, the various social media, in particular we're talking about Facebook today, is being weaponized in the tools of the Western powers to actually try and make sure that the agendas that Western powers have are going to be promoted, and anyone that is resisting or saying different things to what the Western powers want to hear and want other people to hear outside, they're going to try and make sure that those voices are suppressed.
Back in June 2020, Facebook targeted Iran's Press TV, Russia's Sputnik, and China's Xinhua news agency. It labeled them as state media and blocked them from running advertisements in the U.S. It does not take much to see that this social media giant is targeting what it has called as adversaries. And this prompts the question as to whether Facebook has something to hide when it comes to these three countries and their social media content.
In June 2020, Facebook labeled Iran's Press TV, Russia's Sputnik, and China's Xinhua news agency as state media, saying that it would block them from running advertisements in the U.S., which views the three countries as its arch enemies. The state media labels did not apply to the BBC, Deutsche Welle, or other government-funded Western news agencies, nor to those accounts funded by the U.S. government, such as Radio Free Europe. That is a clear case of double standards. Facebook had in 2018 targeted hundreds of accounts that it claimed were tied to Iran and Russia under the pretext of fighting misinformation campaigns. While American social media platforms do not hesitate to silence the voice of Iranian media under the pretext of policy violations, they offer a free hand to anti-Muslim hate groups and Iranophobes under the banner of freedom of expression in a blatant double standard policy.
I think the idea of freedom of speech within the Western world is something that has been promoted by the Western powers, and it's a myth. When you look at the detail of what's actually going on in terms of what people are able to articulate and the parameters within which they're actually allowed to operate, what you see is that whatever the flavor of the month is, whatever the fashion is in terms of the political fashion about what should and should not be said, then if anyone goes outside of those parameters or criticizes things that are outside of those parameters that Western powers want to have criticized, and they will not allow that.
Facebook and other Western social media networks have repeatedly attacked Iranian news networks like Press TV and Hispan TV. Yet their allegations have been baseless. Therefore, there's a clear case of double standards. Western media cannot stand those who are critical of their policies, those who speak the truth, and of those who are the voice of the voiceless, as Press TV's slogan goes.
Now moving on, the United Nations Secretary General has criticized developed countries for creating a stockpile of COVID-19 vaccines, urging them to share with the rest of the world. Antonio Guterres says that he's very concerned with a very unfair distribution of vaccines in the world. The UN chief slammed the self-interest of rich countries for building up vaccine supplies beyond the needs of their populations. He lamented that the COVAX international system of vaccine aid to disadvantaged countries is having difficulties because, quote, there's been a lot of hoarding. Guterres was also cautious about the notion of vaccination passports. He said that such a system would be devastating if people could move within the developed world, but not within the developing world. In Australia, authorities have announced a corona lockdown in the capital of Queensland state, that's Brisbane, to contain an outbreak of the UK variant there.
I can report that we've had 10 new cases overnight, 6 are overseas acquired, and we have 4 community transmission. 2, we will have to go into a 3-day lockdown. This is the UK strain. It is highly infectious. That lockdown will commence at 5 p.m. this afternoon.
The Queensland Premier said that the lockdown is a protective measure and will be reviewed on Wednesday night. During a lockdown, Brisbane residents will only be able to leave their homes for essential work. Masks will be mandatory across the state. The recent outbreak is the first cluster of community transmissions in almost a month in Australia's third largest city. Brisbane, which is home to over 2 million people, has seen very few locally transmitted cases since the pandemic hit Australia. The country has so far reported 29,000 cases and 909 deaths. Now, Paris health officials say that hospitals in the capital are fast approaching saturation point due to snowballing COVID admissions. The officials added that hospitals may be forced to turn patients away in the coming days or weeks and urged the government to impose a new lockdown, including for schools. More than 40 hospital crisis directors also wrote an open letter asking the government to do more to curb the crisis. They said that they were preparing for decisions on which patients should be granted access to intensive care. Currently, France has a total of 28,000 COVID patients in hospitals. The overall death toll of the coronavirus in that country stands above 94,000. Correspondent Paris, Kristen Holmes, says that the French government is being criticized for implementing ineffective lockdowns and failing to properly support intensive care units and hospitals.
Top of hospital officials, they have two main critics. They say the French government has not been able or should take more restrictive measures like the lockdown and the curfew, because the actual lockdown is very flexible and does not really prevent people to be contaminated. A second critics is about the lack of intensive care units. I mean, after more than 1 year of COVID crisis, the French government is still not able to organize a decent intensive care in the main hospital sector.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has demoted 2 ministers in a cabinet reshuffle driven by dual rape scandals. He replaced Defence Minister Linda Reynolds with Peter Dutton, who previously served as Minister of Home Affairs. Reynolds has been accused of mishandling an allegation of rape by a staffer 2 years ago. Attorney General and Industrial Relations Minister Christian Porter is accused of raping a 16-year-old fellow student in 1988, an allegation he denies. The Australian Premier also promoted several female lawmakers in what he called the strongest ever female representation in the cabinet. Morrison has been under pressure after a series of sexual misconduct scandals rocked his government. The allegations have sparked public anger, with nationwide protests calling for an end to sexual violence. The European Union has condemned as unacceptable deadly violence meted out to civilians by the Myanmarese military. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell said Saturday's killing of more than 100 people by the military was a day of horror and of shame. U.S. President Joe Biden also said that the situation in Myanmar is absolutely outrageous. Saturday marked the bloodiest day of the rally since the Myanmar military coup on February the 1st. At least 450 people have been killed since the army seized power and detained de facto leader Suu Kyi. The army claimed voter fraud in November 2020 elections won by Suu Kyi's party. The U.S. Secretary of State has threatened Russia with consequences over what he calls Moscow's malign activities against Washington. Antony Blinken says that the U.S. will take steps to defend its interests whenever it chooses to. He highlighted a shared commitment among U.S. and its Western allies to hold Russia accountable for its actions. Washington has refused to participate in virtual talks with Moscow to discuss their tensions after President Biden called his Russian counterpart a killer. The United States accuses Russia of cyber attacks and of meddling in the November presidential election that Joe Biden won. Moscow dismissed the allegations. Ties between the U.S. and Russia have been tense, with several tit-for-tat actions taken against one another. North Korea has slammed the United Nations Security Council for branding its latest missile tests a violation of the world body's resolutions. Pyongyang says that a meeting of the Council's Sanctions Committee was designed to negate North Korea's right to self-defense. It described the criticism as double a standard on part of the 15-member Council and a direct product of the U.S. hostile policies. North Korea test-fired two newly developed tactical guided missiles last week. It prompted Washington to call for a Security Council meeting in which it demanded more sanctions be imposed on Pyongyang. A political commentator, Kim Do-shu, says that the United Nations Security Council has branded North Korea's latest missile tests a violation of the world body's resolutions under pressure from Washington.
Well, it's symbolic, and also it is obviously under pressure of the Washington to convene such a meeting and to issue such a statement. Basically, it's language, and it will not produce any real effects on the ground. We know the problem between North Korea and the U.S. is really about the security concerns from the North Korean side as well as the U.S. side. But languages like this, it's just a routine. Of course, if there's a statement from the U.N. Security Council and then you have a counter statement from North Korea, it's not the first time we have been seeing such a situation.
The stranded container ship that jammed the Egypt Suez Canal has been almost fully refloated after getting stuck in the canal for nearly a week. The stern of the 400-meter-long ship has reportedly swung around, opening a space in the canal. The ship will be moved after passing inspections. Excavation efforts to dislodge the giant vessel intensified over the weekend after adding more tugboats, with salvage teams hoping a high tide would help them dislodge the ship. Some 370 vessels were waiting to transit the canal on either side of the blocked area. Some shippers took the costly decision to reroute their cargoes, circumventing Africa. 15% of the world's shipping traffic transits the Suez Canal, which was disrupted. While efforts are being made to refloat a giant container ship stuck across Egypt's Suez Canal after attempts to dislodge it failed on Saturday. That's the same story that I just told you about. Officials said that some progress had been made as more tugboats were joining the effort on Sunday. Alternative arrangements are also being put in place in case the operation fails. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has ordered preparations to lighten the load of the stranded ship. More than 300 ships are stuck on either side of the blockage, and some vessels have had to reroute around Africa. Authorities have warned it might take weeks before the canal is fully reopened. 15% of the world's shipping traffic transits the Suez Canal. Okay, and that brings us to the end of this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you.
congratulations to everyone on the 15th of Shaban, the birthday anniversary of the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
Awaiting the global government of peace and justice. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and heartiest congratulations to you all on a very auspicious occasion, which continues to be celebrated with enthusiasm by the faithful, whatever the circumstances, including the current wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Of course, with full consideration for personal and public health and full observance of the hygienic factors prescribed by medical experts. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran and neighboring Iraq, as well as the faithful in our region and throughout the world, are celebrating the blessed birthday of the awaited Savior of mankind, who was born over a millennium ago and is in the state of occultation until his eagerly awaited reappearance by the will of God in the end times to end corruption and oppression on planet Earth by establishing the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. The concept of the Savior may be common to all religions, but it is only Islam which speaks of his universal mission. While it is the school of the Prophet of Islam's Ahl al-Bayt or Blessed Household that specifies the identity of this promised person. Here we invite you to listen to Ayah 128 of Surah A'raf of the Noble Quran before we present you a special feature on the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th and last infallible heir of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Moses said to his people, "Turn to Allah for help and be patient. The earth indeed belongs to Allah, and he gives its inheritance to whomever he wishes of his servants, and the outcome will be in favor of the God-weary." Whatever the Almighty Lord has promised will occur, even if it takes centuries to materialize. He gave the tidings of the eventual inheritance of planet Earth by the faithful and virtuous, no matter how long the wicked tyrannize his creatures who are indeed patient and have full trust in the divine promise. Note the contents of the Ayah of the Noble Quran that we recited to you. It quotes the word of a prophet who was born through a concealed birth. It means the signs of pregnancy were hardly visible on the virtuous mother of Moses, peace upon him, because of the grave situation prevailing in Egypt, where the Pharaoh, having heard of the prophecy of the birth of a boy who would one day bring about his downfall, was slaughtering every newborn male that year. Today, we are celebrating the auspicious 15th of Sha'ban, preceded last night, with fervent supplications in the Divine Court, for the welfare of all mankind and deliverance from all calamities, including pandemics and the terrorism on the U.S. and other enemies of humanity. It is the anniversary of a Moses-like birth that occurred in the Iraqi city of Samarra in 255 AH, corresponding to 869 AD, where the tyrannical Abbasid regime had kept the Prophet of Islam's 11th infallible heir, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, under virtual house arrest. It was a futile bid to belie the seal of divine messengers, who had given tidings of 12 successors after him, the first being his cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, and the last being his namesake, who will rise in the end times as the promised Qa'im al-Mahdi to end tyranny and corruption by materializing Moses' prophecy to the Israelites of the eventual inheritance of planet Earth by the pious. Perhaps many of the Israelites whom Prophet Moses delivered from ages of oppression did not believe in God's promise. Otherwise, they would not have forsaken monotheism and taken to the worship of the metal calf while Moses was on Mount Sinai, by ignoring the fervent appeals of his vicegerent Aaron not to indulge in such a cardinal sin. The Zionists of our own days, who claim to be Jews, but are actually of East European Khazari origin, with no connection to the Semites of yesteryears, also do not believe in what Moses had foretold, or else they would not have set up the illegal entity called Israel, which is the source of all evil today. The U.S. officials, whether Democrats or Republicans, similar to Pharaoh and his courtiers, have no faith in what Moses and Jesus had said, or else they would never support the Zionists, the slanderers of the Virgin Mary and her son, the Messiah, little knowing that Israel is all set to disappear from the map of West Asia. The Takfiris, who with American backing are currently terrorizing Afghanistan after having terrorized in the most macabre manner Syria and Iraq, up to the outskirts of Samarra, where the promised Mahdi, peace upon him, was born, and where his father and grandfather repose in peace, have a scant regard for the words of the Prophet of Islam regarding his infallible Ahl al-Bayt. The Saudis, who blatantly violate the laws of Islam and have recently disclosed their kinship with the Zionists, also deny the prophecies of their religious texts on the presumption that their illegal rule in Arabia would last with the backing of the Americans and the Israelis. If they were really Muslims, as they claim, they would have heeded Allah's promise in the noble Quran of the righteous inheriting the earth. Thus, the ayah of the Noble Quran regarding the prophecy of Moses, which we recited at the beginning of this radio program, is crystal clear. It is food for thought. It indicates that inheritance of the earth is not for the tyrants, whether the pharaohs of Egypt or the superpowers that rose and fell in various parts of the world, such as the Romans, as well as for the Americans of our own days. No wonder Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as is clear from numerous hadiths mentioned by our Sunni brethren in their books, said that even if a day were to remain for the end of the earth, the Mahdi, peace upon him, will reappear to establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. On his advent, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, whose mother was the Byzantine emperor's granddaughter, Lady Narges, peace upon her, a direct descendant through her mother of Simon, the loyal disciple of Prophet Jesus, will be assisted in his mission by the virgin-born Messiah. This will make many Christians to embrace Islam. In the book Bara'adul Samtain, a famous hadith through Sunni sources reads, "The Prophet said, my caliphs are my legatees and the proofs of Allah upon the creatures. After me they are 12. The first of them is my brother and the last of them is my grandson." He was asked, "O Prophet of Allah, which brother of yours?" He replied, "Ali ibn Abi Talib." Again, he was asked, "And which grandson?" The Prophet said, "Al-Mahdi is one who will fill the earth with justice and equity, just like it had been filled with injustice and tyranny. I swear by the one who has sent me as the giver of good tidings, even if a single day were to remain for the world to end, Allah shall prolong that day till he sends to it my son Mahdi. Then Ruhullah, Jesus son of Mary, will descend and perform prayers behind him. The earth shall be illuminated by his radiance, and his authority shall stretch from the east to the west." In the book Ikmaluddin, compiled by the famous Iranian jurist Sheikh Saduq over 1,000 years ago, we come across the following hadith from the Prophet. "O Ali, know that the strongest of the people of faith and the greatest of them in certainty are those people who will be in the end times. They will not meet the Prophet, and their imam will be hidden from them, but they believe only due to black upon white." The Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, explaining this hadith, says, "The black upon white means the writings on paper. It means that these people will believe in the Quran and the Sunnah as recorded in the books, even though they may not see their imam." The sixth imam has further said, "When the Qa'im shall arise, he will rule with justice. The tyrants of his time shall fear him. The righteous will be safe. The earth shall reveal its treasures. All the truth seekers will seek his company, and no follower of any religion would remain except that they see Islam and declare their faith in it." Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, who was brought up in secrecy in the cellar of the house in Samarra, where he was born this day, was orphaned at the tender age of 5. Divine Providence, however, willed that he continue his mission in the state of occultation. As a matter of fact, Ghaibatul Sughra, or the period of minor occultation, during which he was hidden from the prying eyes of the usurpers of the caliphate, who had launched a manhunt to trace him out and murder him, lasted several decades. Nevertheless, he kept secret contact with the followers of the Ahlul Bayt through the well-organized system of wakala, or representation, headed by prominent deputies who succeeded one another and number four. The Abbasids shuddered at the thought of his return as the promised Qa'im and continued their persecution of the faithful in a vain bid to find his whereabouts. But God Almighty willed that his aloofness should be prolonged for several centuries as Ghaibatul Kubra, or major occultation. This is indeed a trial for mankind and a respite for the doubters to reform and rectify their beliefs. At the same time, it is a hope for the believers to look forward to his eventual reappearance without the least pessimism, after having endured the blessings of an unwavering patience that no propaganda of the faithless, no plot of hypocrites, and no treason of the takfiris could undermine. The one promised by God, foretold by the Messenger of Mercy, as both Shia and Sunni sources of hadith testify, and expected in all religions as the deliverer of humanity, will indeed reappear when the world would be brimming with violence, bloodshed, treachery, and all sorts of injustices, as the trend of events of our times indicates. The triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 was indeed a sign of the coming of the promised savior. And so are the current events in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Bahrain, and elsewhere, coupled with the acute desperation of the fast-declining American empire. He will reappear at the Holy Kaaba, the symbolic house of the one and only Creator. He will stand between the Ruknul Yamani and Maqamul Ibrahim, or the station of Prophet Abraham, and call five times for the redemption of justice. According to a famous hadith, before the uprising of Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, there will be five certain signs. Uprisings of the Yamani, the Sufyani, the call from the sky, martyrdom of Nafse Zakiyeh, or the pure soul, and the rift in the desert when the earth will swallow an army sent to Hejaz by the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. This hadith is ample proof that Arabia would be cleared of the evil presence of the Wahhabis, especially the Saudi Najdi clan of brigands with Jewish roots, who are masquerading as Muslims in order to destroy the spirit of Islam through their collaboration with the US and the Zionists, and their persecution of the followers of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt. Another point to note is the revolution in Yemen and preparation of Yemeni Muslims for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, along with the flags of the East from Khorasan in Iran that will coverage on Iraq to save the country from the bloody hordes of Sufyani, who would be unleashing bloodbath in the region. In anticipation of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice, we end our radio program with a supplication to the Lord Most High. O Allah, make him the refuge for your oppressed servants, and a helper for him who has no other helper besides you, and the reviver of the commandments in your book which has been neglected, and the strengthener of the sciences in your religion and the way of your prophet. May Allah's blessing be upon him and his progeny. O Allah, enable us to witness his days, his appearance and his rising, and appoint us to be among his helpers, and avengers of the blood of martyrs alongside him.
The debate.
Hello and welcome. My name is Kisumi Shah Ahmadi. Now, Kill the Bill protests continue all across the UK. While many of these demonstrations have ended in violence, there is still no sign of Parliament backing down on a controversial legislation known as the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill that could give law enforcement officers more powers to crack down on protests. In this edition of the debate, we will be discussing why UK protesters oppose the police bill and how it has cleared its second reading in the House of Commons. But first, let's go to London and talk to Saeed Pourreza.
Gisu, yes, this protest happened across the country. Thousands of protesters took to the streets of London and Manchester, with cities such as Bradford, Bath, and Nottingham, among others, playing host to those protests. 18 arrests were made in Manchester city center, where the protesters have blocked the tram service. And it's become a thing, really. These protests all begin peacefully up until the riot police arrive with their riot gear and their horses and dogs, and the protests descend into violence. And police, we have seen from the footage, have really been heavy-handed in their treatment of those demonstrators. Today's protests really follow another one that happened in Bristol, a place that's seen other protests as well over the past couple of weeks. 10 arrests were made there after the demonstration descended into violence as well after the police arrived. The police in Bristol have really come under fire for their treatment of the demonstrators and for an attack on a journalist, journalist named Matthew Dretch, who works for the Daily Mirror, has posted a video of himself coming under attack by the police, who were there with their batons and shields, even as he told them that he was a member of the media. As you say, the controversial policing bill is being debated on in Parliament. It'll have to clear another vote and survive another vote in the House of Commons of the British Parliament. Then it'll move on to the House of Lords, and finally it'll have to get or gain royal assent before it is written into law. The government has supported the actions of the police. The Prime Minister has come out, Boris Johnson, calling what happened in Bristol as disgraceful. But the fact of the matter is that these protesters are out there to stay, and they're saying that they're going to continue doing what they have been doing, which is opposing this bill, forcing a rethinking of it all by the government. We know that the fact that the government has a majority in Parliament will really give it a strong hand in getting this bill through the legislature and turning it into law. But the critics, among them politicians on the left, are saying that really what this bill does is curtail freedoms, freedom of expression, of speech, like how noisy a protest can be, and things that go with it. And they're also saying that the day that this a bill is written into law will be a day that the UK, as a democracy, will turn into a dictatorship, Kisu.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Said Pereza, joining us from London. And also, we have investigative journalist Tony Gosling, who's joining us from Bristol. Now, Mr. Gosling, why was the police bill proposed in the first place? By the footage that we see, it seems that the police already have enough powers.
Well, funnily enough, parts of the bill the police themselves said they didn't want. And it's a very good report by your journalist there. But one thing he missed out is there's a very, very important part of this, what is being called now here the police state bill, which is to do with trespass and criminalising trespass. That's one of the protests which the police were particularly violent at, even though the demonstrators in Bristol were sitting down with their hands in the air, with their hands up, you know. The police still went in with the dogs, arrested 14 or so of them. Many of, you know, that's something like, you know, 1 in 10 of the people who were, 1 in 20 of the people who were there. So this is another aspect. And the timing is interesting, isn't it? Because this is all being pushed through under a lockdown. And so the mayor of Bristol, the mayor of London, the police chiefs, etc., and Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, who I think is really the one main person behind the police violence, are saying, oh, well, you can't protest because of a lockdown. Well, you know, the 20,000 or so people in Bristol who are about to be criminalised by this bill, of course they are going to protest. They're not going to say, well, we'll wait until the lockdown's finished and then we will, because this is the crucial stage. We're going through into the committee stage of the bill in Parliament, and at that point, this is the point where you need to make your voice heard, and you need to say to the police and to the media and to the general public and to the politicians, we're not going to stand for this bill. You know, there's a whole bunch of people been involved in this Kill the Bill protest movement, which is sprung up literally over the last month or so. But the thing is, this word Kill the Bill, let me explain for your viewers, the bill is the old bill in Cockney rhyming slang. It is what we use to refer to the police. So Kill the Bill has a connotation of killing the police. So that's why it's a bit of a cheeky word to use, but actually, of course, it's the bill they're referring to, this police state bill that they want to kill. Now, this was something that I was involved, actually, as a journalist and as a marcher back in 1994 in the Criminal Justice Act in Britain, which was the first step towards what they're trying to do to completely criminalise trespass in Britain, where they got rid of free parties. They brought in something called aggravated trespass, where the police would get more involved. Usually it's just up to the landowner to do something about it if someone turns up on their land. So there is an echo right back to the 1990s, and really what this bill is trying to do is to pick up on those the criminalisation of trespass that happened back then, and make it actually a permanent thing. In fact, it's very similar to the law in the United States, and quite a lot of what we do in Britain is they have criminal trespass laws in the US which are very similar. But we in Britain have had travelling people, itinerant people, squatters, etc., for thousands of years, since time immemorial. And this is the first time there's ever been an attempt in Britain to turn all those people into criminals. And that's why I think there's been such a move against the police, particularly demonstrations, peaceful and some not so peaceful, to show the strength of feeling, to send a very clear message that they're not going to use a lockdown to stop a demonstration against this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gosling. Let's also turn to journalist and commentator James Tweedy, who is with us from Plymouth. Mr. Tweedy, why is the British government pushing for this bill, despite the backlash, all these protests that we see all across the UK?
Well, I mean, there's more than one backlash, perhaps. I mean, if you're going to protest, you have to be careful that you don't alienate the majority and by causing so much mess and inconvenience and damage to the cities where you're protesting, and that's what happened in Bristol to a large extent. They were smashing up people's private cars. My fellow guest here has mentioned the meaning of Kill the Bill. You know, I mean, it is essentially an advert to anarchists to come and have a fight with the police, which, you know, sometimes the police are quite happy to do, by the way. But Yeah, so these protests are—they've kind of jumped the shark, and they're likely to alienate people. So it's a problem. The bill is like a lot of crime bills in Parliament. It contains a lot of very disparate elements, and some of those are new laws to prevent violent as criminals and sex offenders. And people convicted of terrorist offences too from being released halfway through their sentence on license, on parole, right? They're going to have to wait until two-thirds through their sentence, if this bill passes, to be released. And that's something that's actually very difficult for anyone on the government benches or in the opposition to argue against. In fact, the opposition have said that they agree with that, basically. And they abstained on the first vote against this bill, but the second is, on the second one they voted against it, but because of what happened on Clapham Common a few days earlier, and that when vigil for a woman who was murdered, Sarah Everard, was broken up by the Metropolitan Police, the London Police, but that what happened there was done under rules, which special lockdown rules, which essentially make all large...
Well, actually, it's interesting that
illegal.
You pointed to that particular incident. Well, all of this comes at a time that it's in the wake of actually the murder of Sarah Everett, who was incidentally murdered by a police officer on her way back home. And that would sound the alarm, one would think, for the parliamentarians, to be more cautious about the type of bill that they would bring into law. That doesn't seem to be the case, though, Mr. Tweedy, does it?
But the bill was drafted long before that happened. It was drafted, this debate's been going on for a year or two now, What happened there was that the Metropolitan Police went over the top, and the Metropolitan Police is the commissioner, the chief inspector of that police force, is Cressida Dick, and Cressida Dick was in charge of the operation that back in 2007, which saw an innocent man killed. A Brazilian immigrant was apparently mistaken for British Bangladeshi. John Charles de Menezes, and he was killed. And then the police leaked stuff to the media and told lies about it. So this person, who was, by the way, promoted by members of the Labour Party, she was in charge, you see, so there are these rules that have been introduced during the lockdown against large public gatherings, and the police have been applying them selectively, and it's okay for the police to have that discretion, but on that occasion, it was very obvious, they'd allowed a lot of very large and angry protests and marches and things to go ahead, and then this thing was a silent, static vigil in a park at night when there weren't a lot of people around, and they broke it up quite forcefully for some reason. I don't understand why they did that at all.
Well,
exactly. Mr. Gosling, I think you could comment on that, please.
That's right. We now know why. It's because The Guardian got a leaked memo from the Home Office explaining that it was directly Priti Patel herself that had written a memo to the Metropolitan Police asking for them, or in fact, she's not really asking, is she? She's telling them to shut this vigil down for Sarah Everard. I mean, she's a provocateur. But let's not forget that Priti Patel, back in 2017, was sacked for 12 illegal meetings with the Israeli government when she was the DFID secretary, that's the foreign aid secretary, and she was sacked for those, including one of the things she was trying to do secretly when she was on a private holiday, she was secretly meeting with all these Israeli officials. One of the things she tried to do was to get British public money for the Israeli army in the Golan Heights. Now, she is a traitor for having those meetings, and she should never have been allowed back into government. And now she's actually managing to steal a march on Boris, really, by making him look stupid. And he hasn't got the guts to sack her. He should sack her right now for ordering the police into that vigil on Clapham Common. It's one of the most disgusting bits of policing we've ever seen in Britain, and it's no part of a democracy. This is police state policing being done specifically by Priti Patel, and we've got the memo, we've got the evidence that it was her behind it.
And honestly, Mr. Gosling, it's very paradoxical for us outside the UK to see police violence in response to peaceful protesters that are concerned about exactly that. So what kind of message do you think this is sending the world?
Well, what we're seeing here is, I think, a real hiatus in British politics at the moment. It all depends on whether Boris has got the guts to sack the traitors within his own cabinet. But I don't think he has. I think he's a very weak prime minister. And what we'll see, I think, in the next few months is we're going to see more and more confrontations over this particular Act of Parliament. Just think how reckless and stupid it is of Priti Patel to be pushing a bill through which is going to make at least 20,000 people in Bristol, that is the people who have got their housing problems, that were sort of homeless, people that cannot afford to either pay a mortgage or pay the rent. We've got something like 20,000 of them in Bristol, officially homeless. She's going to try and turn them all into criminals. The idea here, of course, is to turn the forces of government on the poor. And what's also been going on at the same time is complete impunity for criminals who are rich. Particularly, we're talking here about bankers. And in Bristol, we've got the Lloyds Bank, the business support unit, which has been accused by former police officers and by campaigners and people who've lost their property of fraud, very much like the Reading fraud that was also being done by Lloyds Bank several years ago, and that people were prosecuted and jailed for. They're not being jailed in Bristol. So what we're seeing here is the machinery of criminal justice being turned from the criminals onto the most vulnerable in society. And I think that really is a recipe, if it's not stopped, for civil war in Britain.
And it is actually very interesting. Mr. Tweedy, the rules set out in the bill can be applied to a demonstration of just one person. What exactly does that mean?
Well, okay, I mean, maybe it can be yes, any kind of demonstration can be shut down, but actually we've had rules more or less to that effect for a long time now. It's been very difficult to organise protests in London. You have to get, outside Parliament, for instance, or outside 10 Downing Street, you have to get permission. I mean, in practice, they've gone ahead, for sure. It's been done, but you have to... These are rules that were introduced about 20 years ago, which there are already restrictions on the right to protest. It's not unfettered. We could turn to other things. I mean, there's been a certain amount of controversy about the part of the bill which increases the penalties for vandalising public property, in particular monuments. Not other forms of public property, but monuments. There's a thing. I mean, why has that been written into this bill? It's because some middle class white people who were attending a Black Lives Matter protest decided that it would be funny to graffiti a statue of Winston Churchill. And then there was other graffiti put on a statue of Gandhi on a war memorial. You see, so we have this thing where we have Britain is full of memorials to war memorials, and of course most of them commemorate at some point, or many of them commemorate the Second World War, which is the war against fascism, in which we were led by Winston Churchill, because that's the history of it. And there are other memorials to the volunteers who went to Spain to fight in the Spanish Civil War on the Republican side against the Falangists and the Carlists, the fascists, basically. And, these memorials are now, vandalizing these memorials could get you 10 years in jail now.
Exactly, 10 years in jail. That's quite a penalty. Mr. Gosling, don't you think so?
Well, look, the main reason they're doing this is because of what happened last year at the Black Lives Matter protest in Bristol, where the statue of Edward Colston was pulled down and thrown into the docks. And there have been many of us, historians like myself, who have been calling for this statue to be put somewhere less prominent, maybe in a museum or something like that, for many years, and they've been ignored. Edward Colston was a slave trader, but his name is all over Bristol. Colston Hall, there's various other places, Colston Hill. So he is almost, there's Colston Tower. There's various places around Bristol.